Hello and welcome to the Story Grid Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer. I'm your host, Tim Grawl, and I am a struggling writer trying to figure out how to tell a story that works. Joining me shortly is Sean Coyne. He is the creator of Story Grid, the author of the book Story Grid, and an editor with over 25 years experience. Now, before I jump into this week's episode, I do want to mention last week I announced at the end of the episode that we are starting a certification program for StoryGrid, for StoryGrid editors. And I just want to mention that again here really quick. It looks like we have about half the spots already full. So if this is something you're interested in, I recommend you go ahead and move quickly on it. So what we're looking to do here at StoryGrid is expand out how many people can access StoryGrid and access people that have been trained in the StoryGrid method. The number one request we get here at StoryGrid is all about people that want to have editors that help them edit their story in the StoryGrid methodology. And of course, Sean can't edit everybody's story. And so we've been talking about how to pull this off. And we've decided we're going to bring together 25 editors and we're going to train them in the StoryGrid methodology and also train them on how to run a successful freelance editing business. Then make those people available to the StoryGrid community, the thousands and thousands of listeners and readers we have here at StoryGrid. So if this is something you think you may be interested in, we have an application set up for you. You can go to storygrid.com/cert, that's C-E-R-T for certification. So storygrid.com/cert, and there's a little bit more information there in the application for you to fill out. And let us know that you're interested in this. So again, our goal with StoryGrid is to make this amazing methodology of how to edit your book, how to know that your book is working, available to more and more people. And so this is the next step that we are taking here at StoryGrid. So diving into this week's episode, I did end up skipping ahead and writing some scenes further along in the book and just skipping some pieces that I was having some trouble with. So we look at those scenes and Sean gives his feedback and we take a look at where I should be going next. So it's a really fun episode. I think you'll enjoy it. And let's jump in and get started. So Sean, last week we decided that I should skip ahead a few scenes and start writing kind of the real meaty part of the ending payoff. And so I started working on it. I started thinking, I honestly thought I was writing the scene with the confrontation between her and her brother. And then I kept writing and then that scene ended. And then I wrote another scene and wrote another. And I ended up writing four scenes, about 2,400 words that didn't even get to the point that I thought I was going to get. So I basically ran out of time because I was planning on sending you this, one or two scenes. I ended up writing four scenes that weren't what we talked about. So I have no idea what they ended up being. I read back through them and I thought, I had good, progression through them. And then I also went through and I sent you this too and tried to write down every character and their desire and their conflict. So the desire, what they want and what's keeping them from getting what they want as a kind of way to clear my head as I write this out. So anyway, curious what you think about where I landed.
I think you did a really nice job. I think this, you have to remember that you've been building to the resolution of the novel from the very beginning. So to just have this climactic scene or two scenes will probably not make the reader all that happy about it. And just to, as a comparison, the Silence of the Lambs ending payoff is very much in the vein of setting up, the big moment when Clarice kills Buffalo Bill. Now, the way he solved that problem, when you look at it objectively, I mean, from afar, like an editor, is not all that incredibly innovative. He thought to himself, I'll have Clarice have to operate in complete darkness and have to use information that she receives throughout the novel in order to rise above Buffalo Bill and find him and shoot him before he can kill her. So it's sort of like, well, I'll have them both in the dark. And then she'll hear the snap of his gun, and then she'll fire and kill him. So that is his hero at the mercy of the villain scene, when the hero finds that extra special something within themselves to overcome the villain. And objectively, when you look at it like that, and we've talked about this before in a couple of previous episodes, to overbuild the climactic moment to the point where you're pulling your hair out and saying, oh, I just can't figure out how to make this spectacular. You don't really need it to be absolutely spectacular in terms of the external setting and all that stuff. It's really the moment when the character, they find something within themselves that makes them heroic. And the reason why I'm bringing that up now is that the build to that ending payoff was so expertly done by Thomas Harris, and so intricately done, and not this major car chase or remarkable, you know, investigative procedure. It was just a very determined woman investigator asking very specific questions and following her very brilliantly thought way of looking at the world from the point of view of the victim. That is Clarice's special sauce. She, instead of like Crawford, who tries to look at crime from the point of view of the perpetrator, she looks at crime from the point of view of the victim. And it was that innovation for her that led her to find Buffalo Bill and to smite him and kill him and destroy him. So the final resolution of the novel is, again, we're not following the FBI on a 120 mile an hour, you know, speed chase across the desert or anything like that. It's a very methodical, brilliant description of a determined investigator getting the clues, putting them together, and not quitting until the very end. So the fact is that your instincts to write these four smaller scenes are really good. They're right on track, because what you did is you sort of put the buildup on the back burner, and you put all those scenes where Jesse and the team have to fight the Russian European contingency and the Asian contingency, and you took it all the way to the place just before she enters the belly of the beast. And you wisely made her confront this stuff inside of a cave, which is a really nice metaphor for, you know, coming to a new realization and rising out of, it's almost a rebirthing metaphor. And not to get too, you know, woo-woo about it, but that is what you're supposed to do in a hero's journey. At the very end, it's a rebirth. It's the regeneration of your protagonist with a brand new worldview. So using the externalities of the setting, I don't even know if that's a word, but the external setting as a means to get that rebirthing metaphor across was a really good choice. And also you put in a really nice speech and praise of the villain with Randy. Yeah. Randy, you know, basically tells Jesse everything that the reader has held as truth for chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter. So when he does say that to her, we agree with Randy. And Randy's saying, oh, you mean those people who put their two children at jeopardy and sent us here to get killed? I mean, you want me to go back there with those people? What are you, stupid? That's a really, really smart way of getting us to understand Randy's point of view. He makes a really great point. You know, if somebody's going to be a tyrant in this society, why not him? You know, the entire society is set up as a tyranny. So wouldn't, if you're in a tyranny, wouldn't it be best to be the tyrant? Because then you get all the best stuff. It makes perfect sense. So that speech in praise of the villain worked. really well.
So I felt like I put two of them in there, because there's the one where he talks to her, and then there's the one where he talks to Lila, Ernst, and Alex.
Mm-hmm. They both work.
And you said, yeah, you said sometimes you have to split them up. So that's what I did.
Yeah, I think it worked. And you also have Randy mentally agile, but physically, you know, confined to the wheelchair, which was a really good choice too. And then Alex and Lila and Ernst are outside of his, you know, chamber where he's right, you know, from what I understand, he's sitting in the same area as Jesse, who's jacked into the world, correct? So he's
right,
pumping her full of drugs to get her to do his bidding. I also like the way you brought back the old mentor from the very, you know, beginning of the novel. So all in, I think this might be a short podcast this week, because I think...
Well, last week was super long, so that's all right.
You know, just to review what the ending payoff's all about, it's the resolution of the global story. And the resolution does not have to be just one 1,500-word scene. Like in Silence of the Lambs, it's a good, you know, 4 or 5 or 6, you know, builds up to that moment where she has to kill him in the darkness. And now that we know, the other thing that you did here, which was really great, is you established the dramatic irony. We know, the reader knows, that Randy is really in control of Jesse's physical reality. She doesn't know that, because she's in that world and she thinks that Randy might be in another, you know, she's talking to him, but she doesn't know that he's sitting right next to her body and can kill her at any moment.
I kind of set it up where she doesn't know he's alone with her.
Mm-hmm. And that's dramatically ironic, meaning the reader knows more than the protagonist. And that's exactly what Harris did in Silence of the Lambs. He split up the point of view in the climactic scene between Buffalo Bill and Clarice. So we see in that climactic scene, I don't know it off the top of my head, it's probably around 52 or so, or maybe 60, chapter 60 of Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill, it begins with him tracking her in the darkness with his infrared vision goggles. And then in the middle of the scene, it switches to Starling's point of view. So that was the way he established, you know, the dramatic irony, is we saw the killer hunting the victim, and then he switched the point of view where the victim is experiencing, you know, the emotional and sensory feelings of being stalked. And that really, really paid off and worked. Even though, again, the actual climactic moment when she shoots and kills the guy, if you say that, you're like, oh, so she shoots and kills him. Why am I going to read that book? I already know how it's going to end. And that's the way, you know, this also speaks to something that occurred very early on when we were working on the novel. A lot of people would write in and write me specifically and say, oh, we know that the brother's going to be alive. I mean, he just has to be, because there's no body. And that, you know, I was trying to express at that time, and I'll say it again. Yes, of course. But how is he alive is the interesting thing that makes us, why is he alive? Where is he? All that is the suspense that keeps us reading and wanting to find out what is the truth. What's going on? What's this girl? Why is she so important? What's her special skill? You also have Jesse talk about the early moment when Randy and her were goofing around when they were younger, and Randy discovers that she can live when she gets scrambled in the net. So you obviously we're going to have to put some kind of prologue at the start of the novel, but you can fix that later. All in all, I think you've got a very nice core that is sort of, you've got probably one or two or three scenes that build to the moment where she's in the cave, and we have to see As die on stage, in some kind of heroic act. And then after she gets in there and blows up the machine, and her, you know, her mentor is capable of, I think, just a warning, you can't have the mentor be the one who blows up the machine. So she gets him access, but she's got to be the critical person to make the final choice. So he can't do it remotely. She has to do something within that, you know, blog, that sphere that she's in at the time. Because you cannot have a third party come in and do the climactic action of the entire story, or people will say, oh, that's kind of a bummer. I really hope that she would be the one to do it. It's like in one of those Batman movies, there's a really big mistake where Batman is in the hero at the mercy of the villain scene, and Catwoman comes in and saves him. You can't do that. And I mean, that movie, made $1 billion. So when I say you can't do that, it's, you know, they got away with it because they had so much other stuff going on. And I think it's the one where the guy has the iron mask or whatever. I think it's Batman 3 or, you know. So just avoid doing that. She has to be the pivotal player who does the climactic action to, you know, break up the machine.
Okay. So I have a couple other questions. So these are good to keep moving?
I think so. I mean, we can tweak them later.
Should I go to the end, or should I go back and write the scenes I skipped? Should I keep moving towards the end, or go back to where I left off and fill in the gaps for now, right now?
I would go to the end.
Okay.
Because you're on a roll, and honestly, you don't have that much more to write after these scenes here. You've got your big climactic action scene where the thing blows up, Randy escapes, and or maybe it seems that Randy hasn't escaped, and you know, then you drop in a zinger because the other thing you have to remember about a thriller is that it has two endings, right? It has a false ending and then the big real ending. And in Silence of the Lambs, the false ending was when Crawford, the FBI, Starling calls the FBI after doing an interview with one of the victim's family, just to check in. And they say, hey, Starling, great to hear from you. Hey, here's some amazing news. We found Buffalo Bill. He's in Chicago. The FBI is just about to take him down. So come on home. Everything's cool. So at that moment, we think it's over. The reader does. And Starling has to say to herself, oh, geez, I came all the way to Cleveland on my own dime, and now, you know, Crawford's going to get all the credit, and the FBI is going to take down Buffalo Bill. And it's at that moment where she can either do one or two things. She can quit and go home, or she can just play out the trail of her investigation. And so that false ending pushes us, and then we actually get to see, Harris puts in a scene where the FBI goes to this, you know, this other alternative Buffalo Bill, and it's not him. And then the next scene is Starling knocking on the door of the real Buffalo Bill. So that begins the real ending. So you need a false ending and then the real ending. So the false ending could be, oh, we've exploded the machine. Everything's great. And unfortunately, Randy didn't make it. I'm just making this up, and it's probably so obvious that you don't want to go this way. But then the real ending would be, oh, we just got a communication from Randy is, you know, in the netherworld or whatever. He's escaped. And then that's the ending of the novel itself. But it's a tricky thing for you to pull off because, well, it's not that tricky. I'm not trying to intimidate you. But what you want to do is satisfy the reader with this first novel and make them feel, oh, that was great. But you also want to seed the sequel, but not be too cheesy about it.
Well, so I was thinking the first ending would be her blowing up the machine. And then the second ending would be like the oh shit moment when that does not go, like, because that's when everybody wakes up and then anarchy ensues. Because kicking into the second novel will be the problem of the second novel will be dealing with the ramifications of blowing up the machine and the fight for power over what's left. So, or does it need to be more personal than that?
I'm trying to think it through. What you could do is have the first ending being the blowing up of the machine and the second ending being the saving of Jesse's body. So Jesse heroically sacrifices herself. She has to get information while she's in there, probably from the rats or her mentor, that, hey, just so you know, Randy's about to kill your body. So you probably want to pull out of there now before he can do it. And she has to make the decision, well, if I do that, then he's going to become president and he's going to kill me anyway. And there will be continued tyranny and everybody's going to suffer even worse than I can imagine. So she makes the heroic decision to press forward and to actually destroy the machine. Now, it's okay for her family to now come and somehow safeguard her body from Randy. And you could do a situation where you cliffhanger and you have Jesse make the action to destroy the machine, knowing fully well that she's going to physically suffer and die for it. You already set that up with her nose bleeding in the thing.
Right.
And then I think it works if Lila and Ernst and Alex come and rescue her. By the way, I wouldn't have Lila be the one to kill the president.
Okay.
If you're going to bring her back, we can't see her as being a merciless pawn of Randy.
I was playing with the idea of killing her off at the end of this.
That's possible. Okay.
Like I was thinking she would, like, you know, have a change of heart and realize he's evil. She would be the one left to watch him, and he kills her to get away.
Okay.
So I felt like having her go to, because you said with Az, you can't have him go too far and then redeem him. And I know, like, watching shows and watching movies, like, once somebody crosses a certain line, you're like, well, they're going to die, you know? And I kind of was going to do that to her, where, like, she had a good heart all along, but she just went too far. And right. So she doesn't get to win alongside everybody else. That was what I was playing with having her kill President Marcus on behalf of Randy. But we could change that.
Well, I mean, that could be a solution to another problem, which is getting access to that room. You know, Lila could, because she's already killed Marcus, she probably has the confidence of Randy, I would think, you know, because if she hadn't killed Marcus, then he wouldn't be in a position to take power. So her loyalty was proven to him by that action. So again, I don't want to overthink it. And I think the best course of action for you right now is to follow whatever it is driving you now and get to an ending. And then all those
assess from there.
Yeah. And then all those scenes that you haven't written to bind us from the previous action to the cave moment, you just put a big fat to come there. And you may even let them percolate while you go back, you know, after you finish this, you're going to have a draft after you come to the ending of this thing. And you don't have to go repair everything immediately. And sometimes those transitional moments are the most difficult to figure out. How do you really you want to have that big Hunger Games setting, that big climactic Super Bowl-esque pageantry. Those are the scenes you haven't written. And
yeah, I thought the action will be getting from the start of the threshing to the cave.
Right.
So that will be the action sequences. That'll be like the big exciting parts. And then we'll slow down right before the end.
Right. It's like Indiana Jones going into the temple to get that, you know, gold or whatever. And then all those amazing things that happen, you know, on his way out with the, yeah, that's something that you can really play with later on. But I think you're, I think you're pretty close to getting to a pretty reasonable end to this. And the goal is to get this draft done. You know, Steve Pressfield always says, race to the finish, you know, don't hold back. Don't stop. If you can put TK on something, do it and just get to the end, because it's really an amazing thing just to have 80% draft, or I mean, content wise, not necessarily page count or, you know, so that's my advice. So I think over the next, you might need, I don't know, it's up to you. I think keep working toward the end. And share what you have, you know, next week, and we can go at it again.
Okay. I have one other question that's been bugging me the last couple of weeks that I haven't gotten to. So one of the hallmarks of any story that I, you know, and I've been paying attention to this in like movies and books I'm reading, you've mentioned it. You mentioned it last week or the week before in Silence of the Lambs, was basically the protagonist picking up things through the middle build that they use in the ending payoff. So like I was watching this really stupid movie called We're the Millers or Meet the Millers. And it's this, it's, do you know what the movie is?
No, but I remember so it's when it came like, out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a drug dealer that like all his, the inciting incident is he gets robbed. And so he's in deep with his supplier. And so he has to go down to Mexico to like pick up these drugs. And so him and like, he gets like a stripper and then like two kids that like don't have a home to act like they're family so that they can get past the border. And along the way, you know, that like all these things happen and, you know, the kids pick up these individual learning things and they do. And then right at the climactic moment, they all use the gifts that they'd gotten along the way. And it's super dumb.
Have I completely ruined all of storytelling for you, Tim? I think I mean.
No. Oh, no. I enjoy it. It's just, but like in, you know, and in Silence of the Lambs, you talked about how like she was the best shot. And then her hearing, or they're like the malls or something. There was like two or three things you mentioned that she picked up along the way that allowed her to defeat the villain in the end. So right now, consciously, I don't have any of those. So is that something that like we would go back and seed in later, like whatever we use in the end, go back and like drop them in later? Because I, you know, I had this huge argument with somebody about J.K. Rowling and how I believe she went back and added stuff to like make it more continuous. Mm-hmm. And people swear up and down she wrote it start to finish with not doing any of that stuff. Anyway, so yeah, just curious, like what you think, like, is that something I need to be worrying about now? Or I don't know. It's just been nagging at me that I can't think of anything that I've seeded along the way that she's using in the end to like pay off all of that.
Well, what you're really talking about is, it's sort of a convention of the hero's journey, in that I always talk about obligatory scenes and conventions for the genres, and a lot of conventions are universal. And the convention of the protagonist learning little bits and pieces of things that they, you know, little clues that they put to the test at the climactic hero at the mercy of the villain scene, that's a convention. So it's sort of the thing that you would do, and you have certainly a number of opportunities to go back and place those little Easter eggs in. So I wouldn't, I mean, if something radical and fun comes to you that reflects back on the things that she's learned in the three trials, remember when we talked about the middle build and you know, it was probably the most difficult time for us was the middle build and creating a sense of complications that were unique and innovative and moved the story forward and brought us to a place of irreversibility later on. And those three trials, you can go back and look and say, well, what did she learn in those trials? And how can she apply the lessons from those trials in a unique way in the ending payoff? And the first trial was her way of, she shut down, you know, the rules of the game. She figured out, you know, a way to outsmart the game maker, which was Marcus, the president. The second one, she panicked. And she was saved by, you know, the meeting with the goddess, which is a representation of her meeting with, she met her brother in the netherworld, and he actually bailed her out. So it was almost a Obi-Wan Kenobi moment where a third party goes and rescues her there and lets her know that she is important and she has a mission that she has to complete. The third one, she actually gets a lot of confidence together and outsmarts some people in a game playing situation. She wins but loses her life in that process, but is resurrected. So from those three trials, she may be able to piece together a solution to the big problem that would be really cool. I don't know what that is off the top of my head. It's the kind of thing for you to think about. The other great moment is that sometimes you can have the character almost have a conversation with themselves. And it's that sort of free and direct style cheat where their thinking can help provide a solution to satisfying that convention. She could review this stuff. Well, let me think. If I did this, that, the other thing will happen or blah. And then she figures out, and the other solution is, as you suggested, is to just go back and see the little Easter eggs and then have her, you know, pull out the charms in her brain that she learned in the process. But it's not something that I would absolutely tell you to freak out about now. And this is kind of what happens at the end of something, is you start to really obsess about all the things that you haven't done yet that aren't in the manuscript. And the tendency is to say to yourself, oh, well, I know how I'm going to end it. So why don't I just go back and fix some of this other stuff before I write the end at the end. And that's a classic way of really messing you up.
Okay.
Steve always says that resistance brings its greatest forces at the very end of the project. So you have to steel yourself and know that resistance really doesn't want you to finish this ending. Because if you finish this ending, then you've got all of the clay, you know, assembled. You've got your statue. You're going to have to do a lot of like chipping and polishing and all kinds of stuff to it. But you're going to have the blob of David sitting in front of you. And they don't want, you know, resistance doesn't want you to have that. And they're going to do anything they can to get you from having that finished blob. So again, try and put that stuff aside. And this is why the story grid is so great, because then you've got a checklist. It's an amazing thing. You can go through your checklist and say, did I satisfy this convention? And you say, oh, no, I didn't. Okay, where can I stick this stuff in and drop in and fix that so that I can satisfy it in a really fun, unique way? And then you can go back to some of these scenes and drop in little asides that characters say that she will put together in the end, and it will become this cathartic moment where she puts together the clues, just like Starling did. She's the best shot in the academy. She knows the smell of schizophrenia, which smells like a goat. She smells the smell, she hears the click, she bangs, she turns and shoots and kills the guy. And we absolutely believe that she had that power, and we never, ever, you know, question her ability to pull that off because Harris had set that up so well. And if he hadn't, and I bet he didn't in his first draft, he probably said to himself, oh, this seems crazy that this Starling is able to figure out how to kill this guy just by hearing the click of a thing. I haven't established that she's an expert shot, nor have I established her other sensory input. And, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll have Hannibal Lecter lecture her about the smell of schizophrenia. And that's what he did. And he did that probably, I think it was like chapter 12 or 9. And then that all, you know, comes to fruition and pays off at the very end of the thing. So I think you are absolutely right about J.K. Rowling. I think she probably had a very tight outline that she wanted to complete. She did. And then she went back and tinkered and peppered and put these little things in and made it stronger and focused it. These people who believe that first draftitis, that people just have these incredible visions and are able to bang out an amazing work, they're magical thinkers is what they are. They believe that there's some magical thing that happens to a writer that gives them these moments of complete clarity. And there are those moments, but they're never strung together in one session. It's, you know, right. This is, I don't even know how many hours we've been doing this. We're on a year and a half of you working on this. And I still say this year and a half that you've been working would have taken you 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I actually just went back and looked, and we started working on this draft in September.
Oh, you're kidding. So, it's only September?
Only.
What? It's six months.
No, I'm looking 6 months. It's like April, man. That's more than 6 months.
That's 7 months.
6 months. Okay. Because I'm critiquing Tim's beginning hook. Tim has finished the first 11 scenes of his book. Sean wades into his critique. And that's like where you're like, all right, let's just write one scene. Like, but yeah, that was September 8th.
September 8th. So now it's April 3rd. So that's 6 months, right?
Yeah.
You thought it was a lot longer. I thought it was a lot longer. Jeez, that's pretty great to get close. I mean, hey, you know what? Let's not pat each other's on the back.
Yeah. I got to finish it.
Yeah, finish that.
And then, a quick 3 or 4 weeks, it'll be edited and ready to go, right?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to work on just keep working towards the end and send you what I have, and we'll go over that next week.
Great.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Story Grid podcast. For everything Story Grid related, check out storygrid.com. Make sure you pick up a copy of the book and sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss anything happening in the Story Grid universe. If you'd like to check out the show notes for this episode or any past episodes, all of that can be found at storygrid.com/podcast. If you would like to reach out to us, you can find us on Twitter at StoryGrid. And lastly, if you would like to support the show, you can do that by telling another author about the show and by visiting us on iTunes and leaving a rating and review. Thanks for subscribing and being a part of our work here at StoryGrid. We will see you next week.